Today's Taisho is case 69 in the Pien Lu, the Heikigan Roku. Case 69 is entitled Nansen Draws a Circle. Hengo's introduction, where entry is barred, the Dharma seal is like an iron ox's spirit. The monk who has passed through the thorny entanglements is like a snowflake on a red-hot hearth. Putting aside for a moment the seven piercing and eight breaking through, what about acting independently of words and logic? See the following. Main subject, Nansen, Kisu, and Meoku were on their way together to pay their respects to Chu Kokoshi. When they were halfway there, Nansen drew a circle on the ground and said, "If you can say a word, I will go with you." Kisu sat down in the middle of the circle. Meoku, seeing this, made a bow, a curtsy. Nansen said, "Then I will not go." Kisu said, "What an attitude of mind." Secho's verse, Yuki's arrow shot the monkey, how straight it flew, circling the tree. Out of thousands, even ten thousands of monks, how many have hit the mark? Come. Let us go home together. No need to pay respects to Soke. But again, why not? Isn't it a smooth road to Soke? So I want to thank everybody for really excellent sitting in the Zendo this morning. Really deep samadhi, deep motionless sitting. Really, really wonderful. And, when one person sits deeply, it helps everybody else to sit deeply. So thank you very much. You know, because you're here, what the limitations of words are. We believe basically that we live in reality. We think we live in reality. So an average person who might not be interested in Zen, there's a lot of such people. You know, they might say, that enlightenment sounds like a good thing, but I'm really invested in reality. I really have to spend my time with reality. And most people feel this way. They feel that they live lives that are real lives, right? So you get up in the morning, the alarm clock rings and it's 6:30 and you have to take a shower, you have to get something to eat, you get on the Garden State Parkway and you drive to your job, right? Reality. You get to your job, and you're supposed to be at your job at 9 o'clock, right? And maybe you even have to punch in, or sign in. There are actually such places. And you work for X number of hours, and then you get to take a lunch break, and maybe you get half an hour, maybe you get an hour. Then you come home, and you get to come home at, 5 o'clock? Everybody else in the state of New Jersey comes home at 5 o'clock on the Garden State Parkway. Then, you eat dinner, maybe you watch TV in the evening, and you go to sleep, and it all starts up again. Right? And people call that reality. People call that reality. Right? There are all kinds of, urban planners who say that it's, a really bad idea for everybody in the state of New Jersey to get on the Garden State Parkway at 7:30 in the morning. And everybody, those same people going in the other direction to get on the Garden State Parkway coming back, at 5 o'clock. And because if you happen to be a lucky duck like me, and you don't have to get on the Garden State Parkway, sometimes when I'm driving home, I actually see that bumper-to-bumper traffic and think, oh, thank God I'm not on the Garden State Parkway. So why don't we do what the city planners say? Why don't we stop scheduling everything at these in these narrow windows of time. And by the way, there has been the internet during the COVID period was revolutionary, right? You know, people stopped going to their offices. They stopped getting on the Garden State Parkway at 7:30 to 9 o'clock and driving back at 5. Now they could just get online. I have a good friend of mine who's a lawyer in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And he sent on his Facebook page, he sent a picture of himself, and he has on his lawyer suit, you know, this suit, very nice, but he's wearing his bicycle shorts, right? You know, so he's only visible from the waist up during these high pressure meetings. And that's an interesting picture, because what it says is that, you know, actually wearing a suit is not reality. It's a kind of game we play, right? And everybody getting on the Garden State Parkway at 7:30 and in the morning and coming back at 5, that's not reality either. It's highly unreal. But you know, it's true. If you don't pay your rent, you go out on the street. You know, if you don't go to work, you don't get a check. If you don't get a check, you can't pay your rent, so on. You know, right now we have like 8% inflation or something like that. It would spend even higher. If you go to the grocery store, you notice that the prices are, you know, you're paying, you know, 35% more or possibly 50% more for your groceries each week. So that's reality, right? But actually it's not reality. We live in a world that is kind of like a fantasy, collective fantasy, and yet, you know, it seems so real. It has this feeling of reality, and it's worth asking, where does that feeling of reality come from? You know, what gives it that feeling of reality? And part of it is that everybody is doing it, right? So I myself have a car that's almost 20 years old. And most of the people on my street have much newer cars, you know? It's definitely, I don't think people laugh at my car, but, you know, it's definitely making a kind of unconventional statement, right? That you can have a car that's 20 years old. I take pride in that, you know, myself. And it's running very well, or pretty well. But that's like abnormal. And most people, you know, they look to others for their behavior, you know. So I can remember, in my house, my father would, when I was growing up, my father would, begin to feel a lot of pressure to get a new car after about 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And I would hear my parents talking about, well, we've got to get a new car. And implicit in that was like worried about what would people think, you know, so they'd get a new car, and then they could relax, right? And I can remember when I started at Rutgers, all the male professors used to wear like sports jackets, right? This is an English department. So if you went to Rutgers on a winter day, and you had a faculty meeting, all the professors would have like these jackets on. They were like, you know, tweedy jackets, right? And some of them had tweed jackets with leather patches on the elbows, right? Now when we went to the National Conference, if you went to the National English Conference, which is this annual event, then most of the people there would be wearing these jackets, maybe not tweed jackets, Harris tweed or something, but jackets, right? And then, now, if you go to these conferences, nobody wears a jacket. Right? It's just that if you wore a jacket, people would look at you like, you know, you stepped out of a time machine. So part of what makes things real for us is this cycle of reinforcement, right? Cycle of reinforcement from others. But there's other things that make things real, seem real for us too. So part of it is, you know, deep, so we embody or we pick up these habits, which are very, very important. They're called, in Buddhist sutras, they're called habit energy or energy habits, right? So, you know, when you're a little kid, you know, and you go to school and you take a test, you know, part of the message of the test is learning to be anxious about the test, really. You know, that's the getting the questions right or wrong is important, but you know, I think the real message of the test is learning to be anxious about the test. Mm-hmm. Years ago, when I was just starting out, one of my first jobs as a teacher was running a remedial English program at the University of Washington. And I worked with this woman whose name was Colleen McElroy. And Colleen McElroy was an African-American poet and novelist. And she was like a genius, but she got her, she didn't have a PhD, and she got her foot in the academy by running a remedial English program for like inner city kids, mostly African-American, but Hispanic and working class East Asian kids. And I worked for her for a couple of years before I actually ran the program when she stepped down. And she told me once, you know, I told her, you know, I can't get my students to, you know, to really do the work. And she said, oh, you've got to create anxiety. And she said, Kurt, have you ever had a dream where you're in your dream and you realize you haven't studied with the for the test and you're filled with terror? And I said, yes, I have that dream all the time. Still, you know. Another version is you realize that you never graduated from high school. You know, I realize, oh my God, I never graduated from high school. So she said, your job is to give that your students that dream, that nightmare, right? And she didn't mean I should yell at them, but you introduced to the anxiety, right? And we have a subtle education, starting from the time we're born, right, in how to direct or distribute our life energy. You know, so we learn, you know, we learn to hold it in sometimes. You know, so for example, I don't know about you, but I found much of my elementary school experience boring. You know, you sit all day, you know, long hours sitting at a desk, right? And you know, it's funny, I've actually been a substitute teacher when I was going to graduate school. And I was a substitute teacher for like lower level kids. I think it was like second grade. And it was, you know, I started reading this story to these kids and they all got so excited and their faces were bright. They were all talking over each other. You know, how many of you have ever done this? And it's like, blah, 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 blah. You know, it was wonderful. So, but if you go into like a seventh grade class, you know, everybody's comatose. So I think that's a socially created fact, right? If people learn how to be bored and tolerate it. Mm-hmm. You know, they learn how to sit in these rows and sort of like hold that, put that energy in a box somewhere, right? Until it's called upon. But you learn how to sort of like deaden yourself, right? And you learn to be anxious at certain moments. And of course, you learn to be animated at certain moments, right? So we go through this whole like conditioning process as we're growing up. And these habit energies or energy habits hold in place the life we live, right? They give it that credibility, right? So they make it, it's like there's the ideas that we live by, you know, I have to pay the rent. That's an idea, I have to pay the rent. But under the surface, there are all these energy habits reinforcing that idea, right? Holding it in place. And they're very powerful, right? They're very powerful. You know, I had the chance to, when I got out of college, to hitchhike across the United States. It's not something I would recommend now, but it was very popular in the late 70s. You know, there was still kind of a hippie culture. And I remember hitchhiking out across the country, and I spent some time on that first trip, you know, backpacking in Yellowstone. And I had the most wonderful time. You know, I had a backpack. I was hitchhiking with my backpack. You know, I had all my camping stuff in there. And I went camping, and I was camping out, and you know, somebody was camping nearby, and they came over to talk. It was a young couple, and I told them, "Yeah, I hitchhiked across the country. I'm here, you know, camping out, hiking in." And anyway, the couple were like incredulous that I was by myself, right? And it was like, basically, they were kind of saying, what a shame that you're all by yourself, you know, and you can't really enjoy this by yourself. And I thought that was so strange. Until then, I thought I was having a good time. But, you know, they were sort of telling me, you're not supposed to have these experiences this way. You're supposed to have these experiences as a couple, you know, with somebody else you can share it with. And they didn't criticize me, but they were uncomfortable with my happiness, I would say, you know, like, by yourself? No. And they didn't just mean you were, you could get hurt, or you could get, you know, they meant there's something wrong with your being alone like this. And that really stuck in my mind, you know, it was food for thought on the trail the next day that they were so surprised that somebody would enjoy being alone. So you know, these kinds of habit energies are very deep, and they reinforce our commitment to like the status quo, the shared consensus reality. And even when the shared consensus reality is wrong, we tend to resist stepping out of line or getting out of step, right? You know, so one good example is something like global warming, right? I mean, global warming is a really interesting phenomenon because it's the product of something we've been doing for about 300 years, right? And, you know, this idea that everybody should drive a car, right? You know, when I was growing up, that was considered to be like one of the crowning achievements of humankind, that we had invented this vehicle called an automobile, and that everybody could own one. You know, it was like, this was a democracy. Everybody can have a car. And gas was incredibly cheap, you know, so, you know, it's like a nickel a gallon or something, you know, So this was seen as like progress, and everybody was on board with this. And, you know, many cities got rid of their public transportation because it was seen as backward. And, you know, all this time there were a few people saying, you know, this is not necessarily a good idea because, you know, public transportation has all these values, right? But nobody listened. So now, you know, we're facing this crisis, like global crisis, and everybody's saying, you know, every year there's like another report from, you know, the United Nations or one of these international organizations that report on climate. And they say, you know, the way we're living is unsustainable. And it's like the big mystery is, why don't we change? But, you know, actually it's very hard to change, not just because, you know, it would be hard for us to give up our cars, but, you know, our cars, you know, that's our freedom. That's our, you know, we have all of these habit energies that we bring to the experience of drug. My wife loves, I myself actually grew up much of my life without a car. But my wife loves driving. You know, for her, driving a car is like having wings on your feet, you know. And in out west, where she's from, people think nothing of driving like, you know, 300 miles to see a friend. It's like, oh, it's nothing. You know, how wonderful a drive. And it's, if you took her car away, you know, she would feel like you had clipped her wings. Or a lot of people in my family most of the people in my family eat meat, you know, and I'm not criticizing anybody who eats meat, so, but I myself am a vegan and a vegetarian, mostly a vegetarian, but I eat very few animal products. I read all the time. You know, if we all switched, we all just ate legumes, right? You know, it would have this huge impact on the global climate prospect, right? But you know, when I go to see my sister at Thanksgiving, I'm always the guy who has the vegetarian, you know, like the chickpea dish. And if, does anybody want some of my delicious chickpeas? You know, my lentils. And they'll take like a little bit, you know, to be sociable. But you know, it's like the turkey, right? It's like, for, you know, to get rid of the turkey would be like saying goodbye to the memory of all of these people, you know, grandma, turkey with grandma, you know, and grandma's stuffing in the turkey. So there's all of this, stuff holding everything in place under the surface. It's not just the idea. It's not just the practice of having a Thanksgiving, of buying the cranberries, and everybody has a, you know, oyster stuffing and things like that. It's this, all of these habit energies. So if you say to somebody, you know, we should stop eating meat, they all, you know, they go, I guess so. Why don't they change? Because it's like this, all they've been told, you know, when you see meat, you're supposed to let the habit energies out of the box. You know, basically, you're supposed to, eating meat is like letting the doves go and they fly up to the sky, right? It's like, meat, you know. It's like, man, you know, it's this wonderful moment, right? Or you pull out the turkey and it's like, oh, now you can let your habit energies out, you know? And now, you know, when they bring out the turkey, sometimes in some families, it's like those third graders again, chattering away. It's like, oh, the turkey, you know? Ah, oh, you know? The turkey is how we express we manifest our habit energy in the family context, right? It's how we've been socialized to be exuberant, right? And this is why it's so hard to change. And it works the other way too, you know. People who get depressed, you know, their habit energies are crushing them. You know, they're so trapped by these familiar emotional routines that is very hard to get out. And you can talk to people. You can say, you know, you shouldn't be depressed. There's so much to love about life, right? But that's just like saying you shouldn't eat meat. It's like the person quiet, politely listens, but you haven't changed the habit energies. And actually, you know, to change the habit energies is really hard. What we are doing here is not, you know, idea is great. You know, if you didn't at least intellectually appreciate Buddhism or Zen, you wouldn't be here. But, you know, changing our habit energies means like taking the lid off, like lifting the hood up and going in and the deep machinery of our being has to be altered. And we have to go in there and begin to restructure how we distribute our energies. And we have to remove the blocks that are ancient blocks, right? These things that have been blocking us for 20 years or 30 years or 40 years. And learn how to let the energy flow freely. And that takes time, right? Because we've been conditioned to feel anxious. If we're not anxious, we're conditioned to be anxious about not being anxious. We feel guilty if we're not anxious, because anxious is where we're supposed to be. We've learned that. And then when the anxiety goes away, we feel guilty, right? So that's the kind of thing we're struggling with. So this koan is really about exposing the real openness of our existence. You know, existence feels so, we feel so locked in. And so locked in. It's so, everything is locked up and locked in. But by, you know, structures of knowledge, right? So, you know, if you make $1 million a year, people say you're a success. And if you make a tenth of that, you know, you've done a respectable job. And if you've done half of that, you're comfortable, right? And so on. You know, but you know, we're grading ourselves absurdly, right? So what about somebody who hasn't made a lot of money, but, you know, has done something that really benefits humankind, right? You know? Is that person a success? You know, so knowledge and language and our values, which are not usually very healthy, all of those things hold in place, you know, this on the surface, hold things in place. And then underneath, you know, there's these habit energies that we've learned. So it happened once to my wife. This is a classic story. But she was managing a bunch of bookstores in central New Jersey. She's very efficient and effective. She had done a great job. The sales were up. You know, my wife was in the book business, so she'd get up on Sunday morning, get out the New York Times bestseller list, and she'd make notes, and, you know, on Monday she'd call in the orders, and she read the, you know, Times Literary Supplement and all this stuff. So she you know, get the books, and she managed a bookstore in Princeton, New Jersey, and, you know, people would, this very famous philosopher named Cornel West used to come in and buy books from my wife, you know. So, then she discovered that there were two other managers in this company, and they were both men. And they were making a lot more money than she was, right? And, you know, the interesting thing was that she felt angry. But, you know, one of the things, I don't think she would think I'm spilling the family secrets, because this is so human. She felt ashamed. Now, isn't that interesting? Right? That's really interesting. Why would probably the best of the three managers feel ashamed? Well, because making less money could be seen as shameful. See? So you know, the values of the culture are not healthy values. That's definitely so. And they're held in place by all these conditioned responses, all these habit energies. So, you know, when my wife discovered she was being paid less, of course she did go in and say, this is unfair, you know, and, you know, I deserve at least pay parity and probably better. But the fact that her first impulse was shame, you know, that's very human. I think that was, many people feel that, you know, actually. It's like going, when you go to see your boss to ask for a raise, the first thing you might feel is shame. Isn't that interesting? So, you know, change is what we're doing here. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, give you a set of ideas, but the goal of Zen practice is to transform you, us, you, me, us, on a deep level, right? To create a person who is open and connected and compassionate and generous and so on. And we all have a long way to go because we're locked up in so many different ways. But this is a koan about showing that, you know, people don't believe that they are not living in reality. They believe they're living in reality, but they know they're unhappy, and they know that they're missing something, and they know that, you know, something's wrong. But they're checking all the boxes. They're doing all the things they're supposed to do. So how can they be unhappy? The problem must be them. And so, you know, this is a koan. These are three monks, Nansen, Kisu, and Meoku. They're all accomplished Zen practitioners. And they're on their way together to pay their respects to Chu Kokushi. Chu is the master's name. Kokushi is a Japanese word for Chinese word, which means like national teacher. And they're on their way, but when they're halfway there, Nansen draws a circle on the ground. See, he draws a circle. And he says, if you can say a word, I will go on with you. So he's sort of challenging them, right? Say, what does it mean? In this case, what he's doing is saying, look, it's traditional to go to pay your respects to your senior teacher. We three are on a traditional journey to see our esteemed teacher, and it's traditional for us to go in this way. But when he draws the circle on the ground, he says, you know what? There's nothing real about going to see your teacher. It's just convention. And maybe you're going to see him because you feel guilty. You feel you should, right? So there's the habit energies. And he's saying, but you know, how do we know that what we're doing is really good? And how do we know it's really necessary? And how do we know it really is an expression of our enlightened nature or not, right? Or just going with the flow? So he draws this circle on the ground. And with the, you know, in other words, the world humans live in is from the bottom, from the ground up, an imaginary world. I don't mean that if you drive your car into a brick wall, you won't be killed. But I mean, the fact that we drive a car is imaginary, right? I mean, we don't have to drive cars. For 200,000 years, people walked, right? So something called walking. So cars are imaginary, right? CEOs are imaginary. They're not real. You know, they aren't. God didn't say it. And then there were CEOs, right? So freeing ourselves from the spell of our culture, the feeling that it's unchangeable, inevitable, and so on, that's really what Zen is all about. So Nansen, this great, great master Nansen, Joshu's teacher, draws a circle on the ground. And he says, let's open it up. We're on a pilgrimage. We're supposed to be going to see this guy to pay our respects, but let's open it up. Let's inject a little emptiness here. Let's inject a little emptiness and see what turns up. See what how that openness allows us to act differently. And his Dharma brothers, of course, take the bait. He draws a circle on the ground and he says if you can say a word, but he means don't speak, act. He says manifest your energy in open an awake way. So Kisu sees the circle and he jumps right, he sits right down in the middle of it. See? So I'm going to put myself right in the middle of this emptiness. Meoku, seeing this, made a bow. He makes a, actually, it says, in the, literally, it says, made a bow as a woman does. He makes a curtsy. See, it's like, you know, Meoku doesn't have to be a man or a woman. He doesn't have to be, you know, young or old. Those are just games people play. So he chooses to make a curtsy, like the gesture that a woman would make, because, you know, actually these distinctions are not real. And then nonsense says, you know what, we don't have to go. We don't have to go. We're already, you know, we have already learned everything he wanted us to learn, you know. So we're, you know, we know how to create a circle of emptiness and set our energies free and rebuild our lives from the ground up and make a better world, right? Make a better world for ourselves and everyone. So we don't have to go. It's not necessary. Kisu says, oh, what an attitude of mind. Sentra's verse. Yuki's arrow shot the monkey. How straight it flew, circling the tree. Out of thousands, even tens of thousands, how many have hit the mark? Come, let us go together. No need to pay respects to Soke. That's another name for Chu, the national teacher. But again, why not? Isn't it a smooth road to Soke? So he's saying, you know, you could go, or you don't have to go, or you can go. But if you're going because people say you should go, that's not an awakened attitude. And if you're going because you feel guilty, or you're going because you feel anxiety, that's not freedom. But if you're going in a way that manifests your, unleashes your life energy, your beautiful, radiant life energy, well then go. How beautiful that would be.